Hi, Dan.
Who is this?
Who is this? What are you doing here?
Hello.
You're supposed to be Dan. Why aren't you Dan?
I'm not Dan. I don't look as good in a baseball hat as Dan does.
Ah, well, who does?
It's true.
Hi, Stephen Hackett. Hello.
Hello, Jason Snell.
Thank you for filling in for Dan.
Of course.
Dan's on a trip. He's on vacation. What's that like? I already know because I went on one myself.
Yeah,
but it's good.
I don't know. I haven't taken one yet.
Should give it a try sometime. He's not, without disclosing his location, he's not too far from you, I think.
Oh. Yeah. Wait, is he like out front on this? Oh, he's at the door. He wants to record with us.
Oh, no. That's no good.
Sorry, Dan.
The Apple results came out this week. I got to make some charts.
Yes.
My chart script broke.
Oh, no.
Fortunately, it broke at the upload point, so it had already generated all the graphics. So all I had to do is upload them. But my script puts them in the right order with like alt tags and stuff, and all I had was the raw images, so I had to kind of frantically get them posted. Hmm. It turns out this is something nobody cares about, but it appears that WordPress has finally turned off support for HTTP 1. Which I was using because it was a very clever way recommended to me by Daniel Jalkut to get the XML upload of the just a little aside here at the beginning because it's the Six Colors podcast, to upload things to WordPress, your browser uses or at least you can use an XML interface. So basically, you upload a file that says, I am about to give you some files. Here they are, and here's what they're called. And then it takes that, and it goes, thank you for the files. And you actually embed, believe it or not, it's a Vitici thing, right? It's Base64 encoding an image. So you turn an image into text and insert it in a blob. it's just, why would you do that? But because everything must be XML in 2005 when this was invented. And it wasn't working, and I asked Daniel Jalkut, who writes Mars Edit, which is a blog posting tool that has an image uploader in it. I said, what am I doing wrong here? And he said, you know, something is happening where, and I had figured out an alternative path, but then he said, oh, you just need to put in like curl in the Unix utility. You just need to set it to HTTP 1 instead of HTTP 2 or whatever, and it'll work. Like, okay. Let me try that. Totally worked. Great.
What year is it? This is what I love about WordPress is that it's been around a long time, so you can do all this wacky stuff with it, but it's also been around a long time, and sometimes the wacky stuff gets discontinued.
Yeah, well, I think that it was probably for security reasons is my guess, and sometime in the last 3 months, they discontinued this thing and it stopped working. And fortunately, the good news is, after I spent a long time trying to figure out, like, because this is a script that, like, touches, it goes to numbers and outputs a PDF, and then it actually is within an automator action, and then it uses automator's PDF render to drop a file down, which then another Apple script like picks up and then churns through. It took me a while just to build a script that would let me figure out where the error was. But the good news is, since I had done that previous attempt that had worked, and then Daniel came in with his HTTP 1 thing, I just uncommented the old one and commented his, and it all worked. So I actually didn't have to do any new work because I had already found two paths. But yeah, it's one of those cases where you're using an old upload system. And I was talking to somebody who works at WordPress this week, and he said, have you tried our new Gutenberg, our new block editor? And I said, no. I mean, yeah. Macworld makes me use it.
I haven't either.
Macworld makes me use it. And you can paste Markdown into it, and it gets it. It like immediately turns it all into blocks of text. Mm-hmm. But I said, you know, I'm really a paste it into a big open window kind of guy. I don't really need or want a semi WYSIWYG friendly, user friendly editor in my way. I understand why you want to make one of those, but I don't want it. And he said, I understand that. He said, he said, basically, they know it too. And that's why there's like a classic block in the block editor, which I find hilarious. So that's going to be their long-term solution, right? Eventually, they're going to move to the block editor and probably do something that destroys the actual classic editor. And their solution is going to be, we created a classic block in the block editor. So you just create, again, a box that's empty that you can throw your text, your markdown into and not worry about it, because that's what I want. So anyway, that is my worry with WordPress in general, right, is that for various security reasons, they will deprecate things that I am relying on because they're the only way for me to do the... Because all my shortcuts on my iPad are also based on the XML interface in WordPress, right, which has been around forever. And it's great because it means that I can write a shortcut that uploads my story into WordPress. It's great. At some point, it's going to break. I'm going to be sad.
Yeah, I don't use the fancy block editor. In fact, I use Mars Edit, which you mentioned a second ago,
right,
for like 99% of the posting on 512 pixels. I just write in Markdown and send it off, and it goes into WordPress and shows up as a post.
It works
great.
Mm-hmm.
I really much prefer that. I mean, there's the old adage that you should never write in the CMS, and that's 100% true. But I also want to write like in a nice Mac app, and Mars Edit is one.
Mm-hmm. I had an exchange with Grant Brisby, who's a sports writer here in the Bay Area, where he was taught he had a screenshot of an article he was working on that was just invalidated because of a trade in baseball, and it was a WordPress headline in his screenshot. And I said, Grant, you're not writing in the CMS, are you? And his response was, I only write my short stories in the CMS. Everything else that requires like research and stuff, I do in Scrivener. And I was like, okay, I will absolve you. I said, but what I do is for the short pieces, I write them in Mars Edit, which auto posts into WordPress. But then I'm in a real app that, you know, mm-hmm. and it saves my data. And I know modern browsers and modern CMSs are pretty good at saving the data so that you don't lose it. But like I already had that beaten out of me. It's like I'm never going to do that. So Mars Edit for short posts and BB Edit for everything else. And on the iPad, I'm using OneWriter still. There's a new OneWriter, I think a beta that I've got now that fixes a bunch of the bugs I was seeing in it. And so I'm still... OneWriter finally put in my feature, which is that I can use a command shortcut, a keyboard shortcut on the iPad to run my shortcut that posts to six colors.
Nice.
And that, like, that makes life way easier. I like that a lot. But yeah, don't write in the CMS, people. For those
don't
out there
it.
Who are bloggers, just don't do it. Write in like an app and then paste.
Yeah.
That's what I suggest.
It works pretty well.
It does. So I'm making those charts, and the chart that popped out at me that I know that because you care about the Mac a lot is that, and Apple called it out on their analyst call, the four highest revenue quarters in Mac history are the last four quarters. This is peak Mac. We are in, I mean, it may go up from here, but this is the best it's ever been for the Mac. And that's and they ascribed a lot of it to the M1, and that the addition of the M1 iMac just kind of fuels it even more. And they said that they were supply constrained, so it could have actually been an even bigger quarter if they could have made more Macs and shipped them, because they would have sold. And it's just, it's remarkable. Like, the Mac was scuffling for so long, and that even when it came back, it was like, well, yeah, the Mac's nice, but you know, it's fine. And like, this is the heyday of the Mac. Like, the Mac, there have never been Mac sales like this, even close, really, ever. It's kind of amazing.
Yeah, I'm looking at your chart, and even the jump, I guess, in like 16 and 17, when they went to the new design, which of course ended up not being a great move, even those peaks don't really touch where they are now. I mean, it's so interesting because I don't have a good, like, finger on the pulse of, do people who just are buying a laptop for their kid, do they know about the Intel versus M1 thing? Do they just know that there's a new MacBook Air and it's really good? Like, no doubt there's a lot of people upgrading to the M1 who are sort of the Mac faithful, who have, you know, used the platform a long time, are excited. But those more casual consumers, you know, maybe that's why things like the iMac redesign are so important, because it lures people in. I mean, do you have a take on that?
It's a really good question, and it's hard to know. I know that Apple talks about how that in certain markets, like China is a good example, they are seeing, I think they said 2/3 of their Mac sales in China were to people who said they'd never bought a Mac before. So I do think there's still an Apple brand halo effect that goes on, whereas time goes on, right? Like, if you need a PC, if you're going to buy a computer, not an iPad or something or a phone, but like a computer to use, like it doesn't matter in some ways, like what it is, what kind it is, what operating system it runs. And strangely enough, I think that benefits Apple in a way that mm-hmm. Before you would have been like, oh, you'd be a super galaxy brain analyst and you'd be like, oh, once OSs don't matter anymore, Apple's only reason you'd get a Mac is gone. And now I think that's not true. I think that when it's irrelevant, whether it's Windows or Mac or Chrome OS or whatever, right? And it's just like buy a computer that pleases you, and you look at Apple stuff and it's like Apple can make the case like our computers are pleasing, the hardware is good, the battery life is long, it's a kind of a premium feel that you expect from Apple. We don't make cheap plastic laptops. And they still can have that, like, and it works with your iPhone and it works with your iPad, whatever that story is. And you're like, oh, maybe I will buy a Mac because it doesn't matter. And I think that there is some truth to that. I think that maybe it's more their platform advantage of being the people who already make the phone that's in your pocket instead of their platform advantage that is, oh, well, the Mac is better than Windows. If you can work on a Mac, you should. I wonder if that's completely flipped and it's more like I'm comfortable with Apple because of my iPhone and this Mac looks good. So why not? Does that make sense?
I think it does. You know, back in the iPod days, we talked a lot about the halo effect, right? Mm-hmm. You got an iPod and you loved it. So you went and bought a MacBook because all the reasons you just laid out. But a lot of those draws are even stronger now, right? Like if you want iMessage on a computer or photo library all synced over, like the Mac is the only option. And so, you know, we don't really talk about it in terms of halo effect anymore, but I do think that is an angle to it, that people mm-hmm. love their phones. For a lot of people, their phone is their primary device, especially if they're, you know, my age or younger. And when it's time to get a family desktop, they're just going to go with the brand that they have already a lot of loyalty to. And if you look at like customer loyalty numbers, Apple does very well there with the iPhone. And I think that's just spilling over onto these Macs.
Yeah, you're already in the Apple store. It's right there. Yeah, I think that it was the iPod halo effect back in the day. And I think that was serious. I think that was a huge, I don't think Apple could have had the resurgence it had later, leaving money aside even.
Yeah.
It, as a brand, if it hadn't put its brand through the wash and kind of rehabbed it with the iPod.
Right? I mean, when they introduced the iMac G5, the advertising was the next computer from the makers of the iPod.
Mm-hmm.
And like Mac people probably freaked out about that, but it's where they were and it spoke to a lot of people.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Apple in the 90s and when the iPod came out, like the perception of Apple was they made weird incompatible computers. That was it. They're like weird incompatible computers. And we would say like, oh, but if you see a Mac, you're gonna get it. And that's why the retail move was smart on Jobs's part, that Steve Jobs and Ron Johnson like launched this retail initiative that a lot of people said was going to be a flop. But Apple's advantage was they're feeling like if their brand could be taken seriously and if their products could be seen by people, they were going to be able to close the sale. And then you roll in the iPod as a product that made Apple's brand not seem like it was just for weird stuff, but it was like people loved the iPod and that meant they loved an Apple product. And now they're going to the Apple store and, oh, look, there are computers there. And like really the iPhone and the resurgence of the Mac and all these things don't happen if Apple isn't taken seriously as a brand by consumers. And that was thanks to the iPod. That was like the part in the grand sweeping history of Apple. I think that's the part that the iPod played was rehab. Like it was such a must-have product that it made. I can't even imagine. I mean, the iPhone has changed this now, but like at the time, what percentage of iPod sales before the iPhone came out were from people who had never previously bought an Apple product? I would imagine it was enormous.
Oh, yeah. I mean, just from my couple years of experience selling iPods, it was huge. I mean, we had a lot of people who it was probably their first time ever stepping into an Apple store. Mm-hmm. I mean, and you just look at the sheer numbers because Apple, they don't do it anymore, but they used to be like 100 millionth iPods sold, you know, by in this many months, and you could compare those to numbers that the Mac was selling at the time, and it just had to be that the majority of iPod customers were running Windows.
Yeah, for sure. Absolutely. That was the truth. And I say that about the iPhone now, too. It's like, it seems weird, but most people who have the iPhone, if they have a computer, it's a PC. And it's just, it has to be, right? Like, I'm sure that Apple's market share among iPhone users is way higher. Mac market share among iPhone users is way higher than the general population. But, like, there's so many PC users out there that it sort of has to be that way. But it does sort of get those people thinking, whether it's in the iPod days or now, it gets them thinking positively if they have like their Apple experience and think, well, an Apple computer is going to work better with this iPhone or iPod or whatever than what I've got. And, you know, so I think that's part of it. And the M1, you know, Apple's, I think Apple's guilty of overselling the M1 a little bit, but not a lot. When it comes to the reason that the Mac sales numbers are so high. I think there was some pent-up demand where people were waiting for the Apple Silicon transition to happen. I think it's funny because the Pro products, which don't ship in the volume, I think, as the consumer products do, although the MacBook Pro is still pretty popular, but I think the MacBook Air is where it's at. But those products don't exist yet in Apple Silicon, and these numbers are still high. So there are going to be more spikes to come when they ship those. But I do think that some aspect of this is that the M1 makes it just makes the Mac a better proposition because it's still compatible with basically everything and the battery life is so much better. It's also more profitable for Apple, which they don't want to talk about, but I'm sure it is.
It's got to be.
Yeah.
Yeah. The battery life, I think, is a big thing. I mean, I, like you and like probably everyone listening, this time of year, we get questions of, hey, I need a laptop for school.
Yep.
My kid's going off to college.
I just updated mine last week, and the answer is
your piece on that.
I have a piece that I update every couple of years, and I updated it. And it used to be it has decreased in complexity over time because at first it was like I don't know, and then 2 years ago it was like, well, the MacBook Air probably, but the keyboard's not very good, and now it's just just get the M1 MacBook Air. That's it. And end of story. There's no debate here. That story has simplified dramatically in the last 5 years.
Oh, yeah. I mean, for a long time, it was like MacBook, MacBook Air, which is old, the MacBook no touch bar. That's kind of weird. Like, I mean, it was such a mess. But yeah, I mean, I'm excited to see where this goes. Clearly, the Mac has momentum. And as people who are invested in it as a tool to get our jobs done, that's good because the better it does, you know, Apple will hopefully spend more attention on it than it used to. I mean, looking at the quarterly revenue by category, roughly the iPhone's half, services is 20%, and then everything, you know, wearables is roughly 10, Mac is roughly 10, and iPad is roughly 10%. Yeah. So like the Mac is on really good footing moving forward, and I would expect that we'll continue to see this chart tick up as these more expensive, more powerful machines roll out over the next year, that it's going to continue to look better and better on the right side of that chart.
And back when they did unit sales, which they don't do anymore, we would also probably notice an increase in the average selling price as the Pro systems roll out. But we can't calculate that anymore from the numbers because they don't tell us how many they sold. They only tell us how much money they made. But still, like, it's so easy for the iPad and the Mac to get swept away by the iPhone because the scale of the iPhone is so mind-boggling. But just to keep in mind, I mean, the Mac has been doing $8 or $9 billion in revenue every quarter for the last four quarters. So, you know, you can calculate that out. It's like 30-ish billion-dollar a year business. It's enormous. A major, if Mac Incorporated, which couldn't exist for lots of reasons, but if Mac Incorporated existed, it would be a major tech company. iPad Incorporated similarly would be a major tech company. They are throwing off huge numbers. It's just that the iPhone is enormous, and that's just how
They spun out the Newton and that ended up fine.
So numbers, there were lots of them. It will be interesting. I find myself doing a lot of gleaning for the Apple numbers these days because it used to be a little bit more of a thrill ride, and it will probably be again. Everything is cyclical, but right now it's just every quarter when I write that column for Macworld about the results, I have to come up with an intro that says the same thing in a different way, which is like, well, another record quarter. And sometimes I lean into it and sometimes I try to go the other way, but like it's, and again, nobody cares, but I just find it funny that it's a challenge to characterize Apple's results in this era because they are on such a roll, and they will hit a bump and everybody will freak out about iPhone sales or Mac sales will go down or the iPad will have a bad quarter or whatever. Like they will hit a bump or services will not grow and everybody will gasp. But until that happens, like they are in a remarkable period of just churning through, generating money. The machine is running at full capacity right now.
Which is impressive given that the world isn't back to normal. And you see a lot of companies really struggling with sourcing components and supply and demand mismatch. And I think Apple has said, hey, some of that's coming for us. They've weathered it better than a lot of companies at this point. But given all that background, the huge jump year over year is pretty mind-boggling.
The bears on Wall Street, you know, the people, the negative people trying to find a bear case for Apple, right? And I only ever hear about this generally if either the Macalope writes about somebody or it's in the 5 minutes that I have CNBC on before the results come out, where I'm sort of listening, waiting for them to say the results are out and hearing what their analysts say. But my understanding is the bear case for Apple at this point, the most reasonable bear case for Apple is just that the pandemic, and you could throw in the iPhone 13 redesign, the iPhone 13 redesign has driven a lot of sales because of 5G and a new design, and that they're going to have a hangover like they did with the iPhone 6, which Mike and I talked about on the episode of Upgrade that's coming out on Monday. So that's one, forwarding, promoting, we pre-recorded that. So there's that. But I think even more than that is this idea that the pandemic drove a cycle of sales, and that basically it pulled forward a bunch of purchases that might have been made over the next few years because everybody needed a new computer while they were in lockdown for their kids or for their job or whatever it was. And so the bear case has Apple sold not all, but a bunch of computers that it would have spread over 3 years. And so the numbers look really great right now, but the next 2 or 3 years, they're going to be struggling because they will have already made their pandemic sales. And I'm not sure. I mean, Apple kind of poo-poos it, which legally they can't. If they do think that's true, they can't say that it's not, but they kind of poo-poo it. I think it'll probably happen, but not be nearly as strong. And I think it might be outswept by Apple's growth. But I do think that that's the worry that people have, is that the Mac numbers are great for the last 4 quarters because everybody in the world who was going to buy a Mac in the next 3 years sort of said, well, maybe I'll buy it now. That's the argument anyway. I don't know if I buy it, but I think there's some truth to that, but maybe not as much as the bears want. Speaking of Macs, by the way, since you're here...
Mm-hmm. I am.
We should talk about, or at least tell people about, if they haven't heard already, you are making a calendar for 2022 that features your photography of Apple hardware, and you have a Kickstarter that is funding this that is open, and we're speaking on a Friday. It is open until Saturday afternoon, I think, depending on where you are in the world. So if you're listening to this on Friday or Saturday, go to applehardwarecalendar.com and you can see it and you can check it out. So that project, you keep sending me like pictures that you've taken for this project and they're delightful.
Thank you. Yes, I've been basically head down since Wednesday. So we recorded Liftoff on Tuesday. Basically, since then until now, until through the weekend, I'm just doing a big push to get the photography all wrapped up. I've gotten some looks because I've taken, like, I took an iMac to the park and got some looks as I was, like, I had it in a little wagon. I was pulling it behind me. I got some people were unsure what to do with me, which is fine. But yeah, it's really coming along, and I'm really excited about it. It was an idea that I sort of had, and it quickly blossomed into you should do it on Kickstarter because Mike Curley told me that was a good idea. And after bouncing that off some other people, it definitely seemed like the way to go. And it's been crazy successful, which is really, really fun. And it's a lot, it's going to be a lot of work to get them out the door, but I'm really pumped.
Yeah. I mean, you've sold about 1,000 of them.
Yeah.
And I was reminded, I was thinking of you because I was reading about, so Mike Hurley has done with Gray, with CGP Gray, they've done a bunch of physical product stuff for the mm-hmm. Cortex brand. And Mike was commenting about the latest episode of the Panic podcast, because Panic, the software developers in Portland or Oregon, just put up their pre-orders for Playdate, their little handheld game hardware. And there's a whole story there about, again, designing hardware. Once you add atoms into the equation, where you have to get the atoms in the right shape and then you have to like ship them to places, it gets much more complicated. And you're grappling with that too, right? Because suddenly you've got more than 1,000 calendars that have to go out. And that means, and you've got prints that a lot of people are going to get too, photographic mm-hmm. prints. So you've got to get the prints and the calendars, and you got to get them in envelopes, and you got to get them mailed. And I believe you're not using anybody to do fulfillment, right? You're doing it yourself?
Well, I think I was going to get you and Dan to help me.
Oh.
So.
No, I swore off that. I was going to say, I swore off this because people at the highest level for Incomparable memberships get a t-shirt every year. And mm-hmm. There was one year where I used a local screen printer to make the t-shirt, and then I mailed them all out. And that was the end of that. I was never, ever, ever, ever going to do that again.
Yeah.
And so now I give them a coupon code to Cotton Bureau, and I say, your shirt is here. Order it, and they'll ship it to you, and I'll pay for it. But like, I don't want to do that part anymore, because I mm-hmm. getting my family to be involved in like stuffing envelopes and licking stamps and stuff is like, so good luck with that, I guess.
Yeah, it's gonna be a lot of work. And I talked to the Studio Neat guys about fulfillment, and basically the project is probably going to end up about the size where it's just like barely viable to hire a fulfillment company, and it's not budgeted in. So, you know, I would need to find that money. And I thankfully, they're not large items. And I have a brand new studio that has no furniture in it. So that's going to become shipping central. And it's going to be a lot of labor, but I don't think it's going to be, months and months of labor
right.
either. And, you know, Kickstarter makes it really easy. They have all these integrations. So doing the postage is really easy. And I've done a lot of work on the front end. So I have the mailers. So I have basically a blank version of the calendar. When the printer who's local to me, when we were deciding on paper, I basically mailed that to my brother. And I ordered some prints and I mailed it to my brother. Like using the process
right.
through ShipStation and the all the stuff. And it all works. And so hopefully I've got at least the technical issues ironed out with the shipping. But yeah, it's going to be intense. There's no way around it. But you know, this project I was thinking about this morning, that Panic podcast is very good. I listened to it this morning while I was taking a picture of an XServe raid that'll go in the calendar.
Wow.
The picture will go in the calendar. I can't ship the XServe raid because it's like 100 pounds.
Yeah.
But the photo of it mm-hmm. weighs far less. And I listened to that show this morning, and yeah, it really, this has been eye-opening in terms of, yeah, physical products, but doing something where then you add electricity to it, like what they're doing. They're talking about like, oh, we patched something in the firmware, but that broke something in the SDK. It's like, that seems like such a nightmare that I can't even comprehend. But then again, like most programming seems like magic to me, but yeah, next year, I'm not going to launch a handheld video game console. Don't worry.
That's good. You know, just make a Newton clone or something.
I'll get right on it.
I
know there's a really good Newton emulator called Einstein.
Yeah, it's great. I was going to say, I have a friend who sends me all of these Apple II things because he's gotten into the Apple II thing. And then somebody else, who was it? Kieran Healy. Sent me, and he was tweeting about it too, like he revived an SE30 and he's reviving a Quadra 700, I want to say. And
nice.
This is the latest trend that I think is amazing. is people are using modern technology to create new hardware for old hardware.
Mm-hmm.
So you have the ability to like swap out an Apple II floppy disk or swap out an item that's on a Mac SE 30 with a, you know, a different, a programmable ROM or a hacked ROM, or an SD card that contains every floppy disk ever for the platform.
Yeah.
On an SD card. And I think it's, this is like next wave retro computing, which I kind of love, is like, can you use, because emulators, sure, but like, can you use old hardware, but use modern technology to augment it and create basically, like I think Kieran Healy has among the most awesome SE30s ever. It's 32-bit clean, which only old people will even remember what that is, but like, basically, he did a modern ROM upgrade of his SE30 that he was rehabbing, so that it can do more than the SE30 could ever actually do, which is great. And then, like, you get it on the web. It can't load encrypted web pages, but it can load HTTP pages using like Netscape. I love it. Like, I love all those kind of things, those retro computing things, including the fact that you could create a mobile device of some sort that runs the Newton OS in emulation and have like a Newton and like remake the Newton if you wanted mm-hmm. to. And people have done some of this stuff. And like the fascinating thing is that not only is the technology this advanced, but that the ability for regular people to design and build electronics to do this stuff is also pretty amazing. But then again, I'm amazed by the fact that I've got a Raspberry Pi that will let me play every video game ever made, like every right. like console video game, cabinet, pizza parlor, you know, video game mm-hmm. ever.
Yeah, so, I mean that's sort of the beauty of Moore's Law, I guess, where the hardware has gotten so much better yeah. since the software was around. Even if you have layers and layers to emulate it, it doesn't matter. It's still going to be plenty fast for yeah. what the system is expecting.
That's the moment of brilliance, is when a bog standard computer of the day can emulate, and it's a bar that's always moving forward. It's like if you watch the Olympics, they got the world record bar that's moving and everybody's trying to match it or beat it. You know, it's not really there, but like from as a viewer, you can see the world record pace. It's like that. There is a bar that's moving, and it is... I would define it as a regular computer of the day can emulate this device at full speed or greater. And you know, wait a couple of years and it will move up to the next game console. Like the last time I tried to do on the Raspberry Pi, I tried to do video game console emulation and it did the PS1 okay, but it was a little bit iffy. And I was like, okay, so I can do the GameCube. But I can't do the Wii and I can't do the PS1. But like that was 2 years ago when I got that thing. So that bar is always moving, and that's the mm-hmm. magic moment. And then you get to like my Apple II emulator on my Mac. They have to have a menu item that says constrain this to the actual speed of the computer. Otherwise, you press return and everything happens. Like there's a baseball game that I used to play, and if you set it to autoplay, it goes game over. I'm like, what? So that's the next stage. But I love that too, right? That moment when old stuff just is completely emulatable.
Yeah, and that's important because hardware dies, and when it does, it will take the software with it.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, there are stories like the Kieran Healy's SE30. Like the capacitors burst on those old Macs, and so one of the things that yep. happens in that community is you end up buying, and people do this. They buy, you know, for parts only kind of old computers, and then they recap the motherboard, and it's like literally they, you know, the demand is obviously not there for these things that there was. They made way more than would ever be in use today. And so they can take parts and they can get new capacitors and you can solder them on and you can do all of that kind of scary stuff to get the hardware back alive. But you're right. Like there are the simpler solution is to build a perfect virtual version of the hardware that will just run forever on the internet, essentially.
Yeah, it's interesting. I think about it a lot because, you know, I definitely have stuff in my collection that doesn't run. And I haven't really spent a lot of time like learning those really fine grain skills. Like I can solder, but like I'm not great at it. I haven't recapped a board ever.
Yeah.
It's stuff that I want to explore.
I have a strict no solder policy, which when I see Mike soldering, I mean, maybe it'll happen at some point, but like I've had a few, like, because you get interested in computers and you're like, oh, what's this thing? And they're like, and then you'll need a soldering iron. Nope, nope, nope. Strict no soldering rule and strict no circular saw rule. And I almost used a circular saw the other week. And it's a long story that I won't tell here, because the box that I for 20 years I thought had a circular saw in it did not have a circular saw in it. Because my father took his circular saw and left something else behind. Fascinating, just what was he doing? That's a great little gift. He died a few years ago, but I got one last hilarious laugh out of him because I'm like, what did you do here? So I was going to talk myself up, because YouTube videos, I watched a bunch of circular saw YouTube videos. I'm like, oh, it's not scary anymore. So I'm sure if I had a motivation to solder something, I would watch a bunch of YouTube videos and I'd feel like this not a problem and I would do it.
Sure.
But so far in my life, I have kept to my strict no solder policy, which is why I am not rehabbing old Macs. I do have a bunch of old Macs here, thanks to you and the 20 Macs for 2020 project.
Mm-hmm.
Most of them work. There's only a couple that I think don't work. The Mac Portable doesn't work. That's not surprising. Those very rarely work. But the iMac, my G3 iMac works.
Oh yeah,
and
a lot of stuff. Yeah. If it's stored well. And it didn't have components that were prone to failure with age.
Right.
The capacitors that blow, and some of like the displays have these like little transistors that kind of burst over time. It's like, well,
right.
That's not good.
And there's the battery. Sometimes the batteries will corrode and that's bad, or the batteries die and it like without the battery there to keep the clock, it gets confused. But I do have a couple. I have a PowerMac G4 and I have a G4 Cube. And the PowerMac G4, I believe, I multi-partitioned it with like a bunch of old versions of OS 10, because that was my thought process. Was, and you and I have talked about this a little bit, like there's versions of OS 10 that are harder to run, and there's like PowerPC versions that aren't on Intel, and so that you need to emulate early versions of OS 10 on PowerPC, and that can be harder. And I went through a summer a couple years ago where I basically decided, what could I get, like a Mac that would be the Rosetta Stone for like five or six or seven versions of OS 10, and that's this silver G4 that I've got here.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, they had a really long range.
Yeah.
In some of those machines. I mean, when I did my like Mac OS screenshot library thing a few years ago,
yeah,
I ran it all on real hardware, and a lot of those early versions were on an early G4 tower, and it wasn't until I had to upgrade to a new machine that then I would pull another one off the shelf and hook it up.
Yeah, yeah. I think I bought this G4 on eBay based on your advice, which was that one is going to run a bunch of versions of OS 10. That's kind of what I was looking for. So yeah, it's and what am I going to do with that? And the answer is, I don't know, nothing. But it's kind of nice to have it. And have it for reference, and you never know. I did a big history project, right? So that was kind of the reason, was I wanted to have it for history, if nothing else. And if not me, who, right? you and me.
Yeah.
And Andy and I, so we got old hardware. That's what we are. And apparently Kieran Healy, but his runs, which is quite a thing. Let's see. Anything else we should talk about? New betas came out. I guess I should mention new betas came out. They're still a work in progress. You can listen to Mike and Federico get really angry about it on Connected this week.
Yeah, Safari on the iPhone seems to have gotten worse instead of better.
I think it's all kind of gotten worse, but I'm encouraged by the fact that I think that it's a work in progress now very clearly, and that they're headed somewhere else. And I'm not sure they know where they're headed, but I do think that they made the case on Connected this week. You weren't on it this week, but I think they made the case that it's okay if Apple doesn't think it can figure this out to not ship it, right? Like, there's a precedent for Apple just holding a feature for a later release. Because what you don't want is to ship something that's rushed and incomplete and a mess, because it will make people really angry. Because then you're forcing it on kind of everybody when the OS updates come out and the new phones come out. So maybe if they don't really make progress in the next month, Because that's about all they've got, right? Because they got to lock it and load it on the new iPhones.
Yeah, and the betas are behind where they are.
Right.
Anyways, like in real time.
Right, right. Beta 4, they talked about this. Beta 4 was built about the time that Beta 3 was released. So when people are like, oh, they didn't listen to us after Beta 3, you wouldn't see that yet, right? There's a delay. Like Beta 3 feedback won't be seen until at least Beta 5. But they're going to run out of time, and I thought that was a good point that they make. And what Mike and Federico didn't say is, just don't do it. Just give it up. Just revert your feature and walk away, which a lot of people say. And it's unlikely that people are, I mean, it happens, but it's rare that that kind of thing happens. What they did say was, if you're not sure you've gotten it right because the feedback is bad and you're trying to figure out a way forward, don't put yourself in the position of being on a deadline where you have to ship something, whatever is sitting there. Get off the treadmill, right? Say, we're not going to ship this. Let's pull this out, you know, ship something a lot less interesting in the 0.0 release and target it for 0.1 or 0.2. And that's fine. The Apple does that with features all the time. Why not this? If it really isn't working yet. And I don't think it is. I think, you know, there are a lot of people who play that game, which is like, you guys just don't like change, or you just need something to complain about. It's like, well, no. change happens. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. Design happens. Some of it's good, some of it's bad. Some of it we can all disagree on. But like, the idea, if you're somebody who's always negative about everything, then sure, don't listen to them. They're always negative. I would also argue, if there's somebody who's always positive about everything, don't listen to them, because what are they telling you? They're always positive. In this case, I think a bunch of us have looked at this and analyzed it and said, it doesn't work. Even if we understand why they're trying to do it, which I've been really open about, like, I think what they're trying to do is kind of admirable. I like understand the precepts involved, but the execution just, like, it doesn't outweigh the downside of the decreased legibility of the interface. And to me, that's the key word, is legibility. Like, you can't tell which tabs are, you can't read the tabs. You can't tell which tab is active. You can't tell which button to press. You can't press it right. Like, these are fundamental issues.
Yeah.
So keep working on it.
Especially when Apple's ethos has been clarifying and minimizing UI in deference to content. And like Safari and the iPhone in particular doesn't really do that in the way that they've talked about for a long time. The other thing that just kills me about it is why Safari? Like, right? I mean, mail and messages, and there's lots of other kind of standard apps that are full of content. But Safari is the one that's going way out of left field if this current design stands.
And I think it's the most important app in iOS. And macOS, really, but
yeah,
definitely
I mean, yeah,
iOS.
I mean, oh, yeah. And so why is that the one that got picked for something that has turned out to be risky?
Know.
You know, and if this is such a good idea to have things at the bottom, which I think it is, as someone who uses a giant phone, why is that not part of these other important system apps, too? It just, putting Safari out there in front just seems such a strange choice to me.
Well, also, just, you mentioned the giant phone. Like, I think number one reason why I support their changes on the iPhone is that putting as much at the bottom is, with big phones, you got to do it. Like, you can't reach to the top. You got to put them at the bottom. There was, you know, originally the iPhone interface was top-centric, but the phone was small. And then the phone got way bigger, and you can't reach up there anymore. And they added that ridiculous reachability feature in order to, like, hack your way to...
Oh, gosh,
I mean,
yeah.
It's so, okay, that's fine. But at the same time, like, why are you trying to save vertical space if you're on a giant phone? Like, I kind of don't get it. Like, they're trying to do both, right? They're trying to mash everything down, or on a Mac, right? Or really, I have a big iPad. Like, even on the iPad, I'm like, I don't need that space. On the Mac, I certainly don't need that space. So I feel like there's some competing things going on there that don't necessarily make sense, and that's why. And my history in redesign projects and interface design projects, and I do have them, right? I worked at a magazine and a website, and we had an app, but really that website, like, a huge part of my job was dealing with changes to the website day to day and working with designers and all of that. And all I can say about this project is this: once you start pulling it apart, you're probably better off pressing pause, going back to basics, and kind of like really thinking it through. And what I have seen in beta 3 and 4 is them desperately trying to make little changes to salvage the whole big thing. And I don't think it's going to work. So when I say that I really like what Federico and Mike said, I am saying it because of that. I think it would be, I think they're going to get a better thing that satisfies them and satisfies users if they don't feel like they're under the gun and they press pause and commit to shipping it, but a little bit later, and that it's going to take a little more time, because you don't get good designs by coming up with a completed project and then slapping a bunch of buttons on it to silence the complainers. You don't get a good result. You get a mess. It's like, it's the proverbial tapestry where you pull on one thread and the whole thing unravels. You can't do it that way. So I hope they, you know, I appreciate that they're listening to feedback. That's great. And next step is, if they don't really have a coherent design, they need to be able to say, let's not ship this yet. We'll see. Yeah.
It's rare, summer drama. But there's precedent. Yeah. And
copy tabs.
Oh, Safari 4.
Yeah.
I came across that, the Safari 4 beta, like press release, when I've been doing the calendar stuff. And right there in the copy, tabs on top.
Yeah.
That didn't last very long.
No, did not.
That was a weird time.
Well, Stephen, thank you for filling in for Dan.
Of course. Happy to do it.
And applehardwarecalendar.com.
Go get it.
Go get it. Bye, Stephen.
Bye, y'all.